You are listening to Jaya Ashmore. You can find hundreds of meditations and talks on my websites, jayaashmore.org, jayaashmore.org, as well as opendharma.org, opendharma.org. All the recordings are offered in the tradition of generosity or dana, and your gifts are welcome. Thank you for listening. Are you cold? You were going to say something yesterday. Is it still current?
A little bit. I guess I'll just say it. We were talking about how with intentions, that there's always this like relativity to it where you don't really know where you're at in the spiritual path, and there's the conditioning inside of yourself that exists such that when you make an intention, who knows if it's going to be the thing that's best for you or the thing that's going to take you down the path. And someone asked a question about making choices and being confused, because I struggle with the same thing. Things come up deciding what action to take or not to take an action, whether to sit with it. And I was going to offer that with all this stuff, you know, all this stuff is empty, we're not in control, but, like, there has to be something here for us to still go on, and I wonder if you would touch on, and that's been something that I talked to you about before, with the trust in the practice.
Yeah.
And so I just wanted to bring that up.
Do you want to just say, like, a little tiny bit about what you experience about trust in the practice? Just a little.
So with me, it's like when I have something difficult come up. Like the first day that I was here, I wasn't sure what was going on. I just felt really unhappy, and thoughts were coming up related to that. But instead of like getting caught in the thoughts and making judgments about what it all meant, and I've also been having lots of dreams that I could say mean certain things. Instead of doing that, I've been trusting that the more I sit and the more I just let those things kind of ruminate in the background, that there will be a process of knowing and wisdom that comes out of that, and that's kind of why, that's kind of the power.
Yeah. Cool. So I guess what I had wanted to say today anyway is very related, so I'll say a little bit in this direction that I have in mind. So, once, not too long ago, someone named Oliver Sacks, so some of you might have heard of him. Doesn't matter, he's a guy. He's a scientist. He's a doctor. He was visiting, I think he was in Norway, and he was really psyched about taking this long walk. He'd seen this mountaintop, and he was like, I'm going to do the mountaintop in one day, go up and back. And he was very enthusiastic about this hike. He left really early in the morning so he'd have time to get up and back. Like, it was still dark, he was walking up. And he was really happy walking along, and he talked about feeling the music of the rhythm of the walking. And not too far up, maybe let's say about a third of the way up, he came to this fence with a gate and a sign. And the sign said, "Danger, bull." And I think there might have been a picture of a bull on the sign or something. And he was like, "Bull? Like what?" And he opens the gate and walks up. And he's getting quite near the top of the mountain, and he comes around a corner, and there's the bull, who's like just happily lying on the ground, chewing its cud until it sees this guy come around the mountain. I was happy that Karina saw the cow that was just behind that well or something, that we didn't startle the poor cow into an alarm. So the bull got up and chased after Oliver Sacks, and Oliver Sacks ran as fast as he could. And in his alarm, he fell really badly and realized he couldn't move one of his legs. So at first, as a doctor, he told himself what to do. Like in his own head, he split into doctor and patient and gave himself advice. And he managed somehow with his umbrella to splint his leg, like to tie his leg onto the umbrella to keep it from falling around. And then he rode down the mountain. But he wasn't going to make it, you know? It was way too far, but he just kept trying. Since he's telling the story, you know that he made it. But even his sort of psyche at some point, as it's starting to get dark and he's not far enough down for people in those lovely twinkling villages down there to see him up there way up on the mountain, rowing down the mountain with his arms. His psyche starts doing that thing that we hear about where your life passes before you. he started remembering, memories were coming about everything. They just came. So his whole life came as he was rowing down the mountain. And the way he got as far as he did get was that he again found some kind of music in the movement. It took a while, but he managed to, even though he'd never moved this way, his body found it, and he could go pretty fast. And one of the times that he thought he heard something and he thought, "Oh my God, it's the bull," just in time, it was already dark, there was a shepherd or something. Someone was there. And they got him to the hospital. He had a really cool doctor who also had experienced some kind of break and was to show that eventually you'll be fine, was like jumping up on the table and dancing around. And I found that sense of humor in times of alarm is really, really important. So I think that might have, when I was in the ambulance last summer with my broken ankle, where my ankle was like this, the medic who was in the car with me and I just laughed so much the whole way. My mom was in the front of the ambulance with the driver, and she was worried that, this is so my mom, she was worried that when we got to the hospital, they were going to think we were on drugs because we were laughing so much. And that must be why I'd broken my ankle or whatever. Motherly paranoia, you know. But I'm pretty sure that it was because of laughing so much that I wasn't actually in any pain. And so the doctor wrongly told me that probably it was just dislocated. Anyway, so Oliver Sacks also got a good treatment with some laughter and good care. And so the physical part got taken care of pretty well. But there was some kind of nerve damage, and so he couldn't quite connect to his leg and get it to move. And so he went through this whole journey of realizing that there's this thing that can happen when we can't feel or can't move a part of our body. It can happen that it kind of, our brain loses it. So maybe you've heard about the kind of, in the neurons, the map of the body, like there's supposed to be a place in the brain that has the sensory neurons for all the parts of the body, and like the lips are really big because they're so sensitive, and that body map in the mind. So that map, though, is not just like this, it doesn't stay the same all the time. Apparently within hours, if it might happen that for some reason, which happened to Oliver Sacks later on, that his arm got injured in another accident, and they immobilized his arm. And within hours, he started to notice the same thing happening, that he lost his arm, was not on his map anymore. So the arm was there, but the brain didn't recognize this thing anymore as his own. So he's guessing that in that map, it was gone. And so the doctor said, oh, whoa, okay, let's get it moving again. And it came back. And you can imagine going through with the surgeon thinking just, he's crazy. The surgeon who had had plenty of other patients who'd reported the same thing, but didn't quite have time to realize this is something that happens. If we can't use something for a while, if we can't move it and sense it for a while, our system stops taking it as mine. So he was in bed and he'd fallen asleep after maybe a horrible night of sort of nightmares about somebody else's leg being on his bed. And he finally fell asleep, and there was a friendly person in the hospital who came in for something. And she came in and saw his leg was just hanging off the bed. The injured leg was just hanging off the bed, almost ready to pull him off the bed. And she was like, what are you, what, oh. And he was like, what? What? And sort of the feeling he had inside was, what is that and whose leg is that? It was completely alien to him. So I think, as with most sort of real experiences in life, what actually happened can resonate with what happens on the spiritual path in many ways. But what I want to talk about here is how important it is to notice what we're moving and sensing and in touch with a lot, and how that sort of takes up a lot of space in our internal map of what we are, and how much we're not even touching, and so we've lost it. So with his leg, to get his leg back, he has the leg. The leg is supposed to work. Like, physically, the surgeon is like, come on, walk, dude. And he couldn't walk. He figured out that the only way he could get walking and his leg back, with the friendly person in the hospital, they figured out, if he could trick himself into doing it naturally, into getting into the music. And so he turned on some music. And he would trick himself into walking for a while, and it would work perfectly. He could walk, but then maybe he had to stop and turn around, and it got lost again. So maybe according to the scriptures, we have this perfectly functional Buddha nature somewhere. But we've lost it. We have perfectly functional self-kindness. And joy in life. And we just lost track of it. Because there kept being some kind of pressure to focus on other things, to feel and sense and move other things. So to row ourselves around instead of walking. And so yesterday we talked about how techniques of meditation, so-called techniques of meditation, it's like ways of tricking ourselves into walking and finding that we have a leg, that thing is your leg, that thing is your kindness. And even though there's somewhere in us, probably in most of us, somewhere deep also, that actually will not believe that this whole enlightenment thing is actually for you. Or that being okay or being happy or being free is for you. But somewhere else, let's say even deeper, just knows that and has that leg and can walk on it. And so even though it should be simple and it should work, it doesn't. Until we trick ourselves with the help of some kind of music. Something that reminds us of the naturalness of being kind and open. That reminds us that even though it seems like we only have one leg, so can you imagine that just like this really happens to people? That leg that's right there next to you is somebody else's. That's your experience. They call it a kind of bottom-up disturbance. So usually we think of going crazy as a top-down experience. Something goes wrong up here, and then we start to experience weird sensory experiences. This is a weird sensory experience that kind of filters up. The body, the nerves were cut or whatever. The leg couldn't be felt for a while. And then the actual experience that's an alien thing. So maybe inside us, we've gotten so used to really thinking that really limited area is me. That those certain specific limited experiences are what I am. Mostly my troubles. Mostly the friction. And how would it be to just all the same person? You're the same person. What if just simply your sense of what you are got located somewhere limited? And that's all. Just like we used to think it was just us in our little planet with the kind of daily and nightly performance of the celestial bodies. And then it was just our solar system, etc. Because maybe what we are, maybe one reason it's so cool to be in the mountains is that the mountains remind us of how big we are. And maybe one reason it's so cool to be at the ocean is that that wide horizon reminds us of how big we are. Doesn't it? No?
It reminds me how small I am.
Okay, so how small that is. That thing I thought it was. Yeah. In this case, how small I am, how big I am, is the same thing for me. It may be different. Like for Oliver Sacks, he had walked for quite some decades before he lost his leg. And so it might be different when, if we're tricking ourselves into remembering how to walk, when we have walked. It might be different if we're tricking ourselves into walking and we've never walked. And I think that's hard for us. I think it's like already so hard to try to deal with feeling like I have one leg, thinking maybe I have another leg, but where is it? And trying to trick ourselves into walking. But then on top of that, that we actually also have to learn how to walk. Or it's like we have a seed leg and we have to grow the seed from the seed to the leg. So we have to trick ourselves into finding the seed and then also grow that. Which would be beautiful if we were okay with that, if we didn't take it as sort of insulting or too much for us beyond our capacity. But growing, even growing our capacity, it's just such a cool thing, because it's not that we have to do the growing. That's not our job. Growing knows how to grow. It's just giving good growing conditions. Just. It's a full-time job. But it's a devotion. And it's a devotion to something worth being devoted to. It's a devotion that is fulfilling along the way. Finding the seed is fulfilling. And that's that small and big, like we don't have any idea how the seed goes from seed to leg. But feeling and being part of that, helping that happen. And all the kind of capabilities that get learned as we serve that growing. It's so fulfilling. It's much better than thinking we should have a leg and pretending to have one. Or trying to just find a fake leg and stick it on or whatever. And so if we can just feel how often our expectations of how it's going to be keep us from enjoying what it is, how it's going. So let's say it's like waking up the seed leg. It's very weird, very bizarre metaphor. It also, I think, quite accurate, but. For example, if it's something like waking up, then we could notice when we wake up from sleep, how is it? It's a whole beautiful process, waking up. It's not that the moment we're awake the body and mind are the same as they're going to be a few hours later. So for example, everyone is different, but sometimes there's about half an hour where the mind is not as sharp. Some people wake up like very sharp, but sometimes it's like half an hour-ish. Where you might maybe go to the bathroom and forget why that you were going to brush your teeth or something. But something you might remember something else way more important. You're going to remember to brush your teeth probably, eventually. But if we move too fast, I'm like, oh, come on, you were going to brush your teeth, or whatever. We might miss the other remembering, the other kind of remembering that's available at the beginning of waking up. And we could also feel for where there are situations that draw us out of experiencing ourselves as that small and draw us into experiencing ourselves differently, finding some other part of the body that we'd otherwise forget about. So I remember the first year that I was teaching in Ladakh for the summer. And the person who was managing all the retreats was a moody person. And she talked about being a moody person, and she was a moody person. And she really appreciated how, as a manager, her moods didn't matter. It didn't matter if she woke up in a bad mood because she still had to be there to help someone put cream on their hemorrhoids. The kind of things that might happen when you're a manager. You never expected. Or someone can't remember where they put their shoes and things like that. So if she didn't need to be there for other people every day for the summer, the map in her brain of her moods would be really big. But it's so easy to forget that we love demanding situations. It's so easy to forget it. It's so easy to get drawn towards where I can have my moods. And so it's not to go to an extreme. That would be the easy, an easy way out. To constantly be in a situation where how you feel doesn't matter. That's not the idea either. But to be in situations that just sort of tug you out of that small thing that you think you are. Not just that you think you are, you experience that you are. And so one of the dangers of the instructions, just say with the direct experience, is sometimes the direct experience, mostly, is that really small place that our psyche gets sucked into. Noticing that smallness, it's often as if we got that sort of impression, that imprint, that shape, and something wants to just keep coming back into that little shape. And so everywhere we go, we experience people as being like my mother, like my father, like my brother, like my ex, like my... whether they are or not. And we invite them to be like our mother and our father and so on. Sometimes we can feel the smallness happening by the shape of the body. Or sometimes we can feel or hear the quality in the mind. And it is good and important to get to know the shape, and it's, I think, much more important to practice feeling through that shape or interference, we called it yesterday. It can feel like it's in our way, it's an obstacle, it's a wall. And then we kind of get all into feeling it, and then that's all we can feel. But like feeling right through it. To what we love. Feeling what music helps you land in the place where you love what you love. And being seated there. Just being seated there. Saying this phrase, love what you love, is very much my own language. And so we need to find out your language also. The first evening I asked you to feel why you're here. And someone mentioned today really liking the question and then also going into a tailspin, which is when like part of the plane gets crashed and it just goes around in circles until it hits the ground. So for him, there was somewhere a sense of knowing why I'm here, the simple and clear. Knowing of what is my experiment in this life? What am I willing to gamble on? So we're in situations where there's a decision that seems to need to be made. maybe it doesn't. That might be our setup, but maybe we have to decide something. Maybe we need to respond or take a step. The why we're here question is feeling, okay, there's what I would normally react. There's what I think I should do. There's what I think everybody else is doing or would do. All of these are so tempting. It sounds easy to reject them when you just say it like that. It's so tempting. So, but even where the pressure is on, the decision is important. It's going to make a difference in your life and maybe other people's lives. And you maybe even feel upset and alarmed and afraid about making the wrong decision, taking the wrong step, too soon, too late. What is your way of walking with your music that you want to find out? That's what you want to find out. Can I walk this way? Not am I able to, but more like I want to know if this kind of walking kind of works or is allowed or if I'm going to survive. So I'm even willing to die. I'm willing to give up everything because I want to know if I can, if love is enough. If staying true to love is enough. That's what I want to know. So feeling why you're here, which might not, of course, might not be the word love. It might not, doesn't even need a word. But find out what you're willing to gamble on. Even if it's wrong, you'll find out. So asking ourselves why we're here and somewhere being honest to feel there is some place that's willing to gamble on that. It's willing to gamble on that no matter what. And then there's the doubts, like, am I really? Is that the right thing? Etc. Who am I to? But first, I need to tidy all this up. Okay. Do you have enough to go on to sense what I'm saying, but in yourself? Wait.
I didn't understand one thing.
Yeah.
You said that the direct experience can be dangerous. But I couldn't understand how to avoid it.
Okay. Good. That's like the main point of the talk, so it's good to go over it again. No, not at all. Main and subtle, so it's good. It's really good to say again. So, so if it can happen that the direct experience in a body with two legs is that I have one. Then I may need music to help me feel. I may need something that kind of gets me in another mood that's not trying too hard. He tried so hard to move his leg. So something that gets us somewhere else and gets something flowing that's maybe about beauty or harmony or creativity, but where I can feel through what seems to be real but doesn't quite take something into account that keeps following me everywhere. Like the guy's leg. To feel for then what you're here for. Even though it looks like I don't deserve that, or I'll never get there, or maybe I'm already there, or something. It's not, it doesn't fit into my bubble of what I think I am. But what I think I am also can't quite explain everything. And so just the subtle feeling through what seems to be a wall, keeping you small. So tuning out from the sense that you've got to work on your problems first, you've got to fix something first, etc. Tuning out from all the stories, actually. Or all the stories, if you like, except the one about what's your heart song or what you're here for, what you would gamble on if no one was looking. Or if you had everything gathered together and you had one gesture left, that is it. Because you're going to die anyway. So feeling, that all sounds dramatic, but it's just feeling through all these very easy to feel experiences and sensations and stories too. And it's not saying those stories don't have some truth or validity, but feeling through all of that. To feel what you're here for. And then feeling what you're here for, feeling the intimacy with that. So I call it loving what I love, or loving love. You'll have to find your own symbolic language for it, for what that is in you. But there's love and loving love. There's love and finding that that I love is already here, and I stay here with that. So, what are you here for? You don't have to answer. Okay, but it's also one of the things that we do instead of just feeling it is say, yeah, now I have this problem of putting my problems to the side so that then I can feel that. And it's just at some point, do it now. The problems are going to always be there. And the problem of needing to put them aside is always, maybe not always, but it's going to be there basically for a long time. It's not about the problems or getting them to do anything different from what they're doing. It's the already here. Love of what you love. The already here devotion to life. Anybody who, I haven't forgotten you, but anybody who hasn't spoken want to say anything? Okay, Emil, please.
2 days I kept waiting for this question, two questions. I asked it a lot of times, and still with some logical beauty and difficulty behind it, and it's very close to those topics we had now and yesterday. So it got very strong again, and I wonder how could you explain more about it. I try to start with to take decisions. So do we have a choice? Do we not? Many people say we don't have any choice at all. And as you said also an answer to this question, if we have a choice, and you said maybe a little bit of a choice we have. I can remember 3 days ago.
Probably I tried to avoid the question because that will be another big talk.
I was also very nervous about questioning this. I can feel. For me, some kind of an answer about that is the mind thinks a lot, being able to decide. And if I'm living a lot in this mind state and system with one and a half legs in that way, it's a lot of deciding. Seems really, really real that I can decide because I just see myself stopping. Oh, should I go this way or should I go that way? And then I go back. If I would have had, then I would. So next time this. And it really looks very much as deciding. And then it came up when I'm more into it, living it and being and watching it walk, watching it do, and coming more into that deep trust and away from a lot of thinking and living it, then it feels much more than there is almost no choice, and it will decide through another system of decision brain intelligence, where the mind of this what seems to decide now in this mindful quarrel.
Mindful what?
Mindful quarrel.
Quarrel, okay.
Of this, try to control this life and difficulties of decisions. It's now very complicated, but in the end, these will, I think, come away, and then there is maybe really no choice in the end. The confusion which keeps me asking this question is that some people say we have no choice at all. And if we look in astrology or Kabbalah, Maya, many systems and even dreamers or hell-viewing people, high-viewing people as they know what's happened in future, means also that there is, in the end, no choice. So I'm very curious about that. But also happy to experience it more and more.
I think that it. What could be interesting is either way, then what? Yeah. So what if we find out there was no choice? How did you live your life? Or how do you want to live your life? Or what? What? Or if we would find out we have a choice, then what? Maybe there's somewhere kind of more important question or more interesting place, since maybe we can't quite know, because some people say this, some people say that. And I think maybe a lot of people who would say this or that would say also it's really beyond understanding or beyond logic. So if we could say, well, whether I have a choice or not, I can't, so far, what I can say, I can't tell. I can't find out so far if I have a choice or not. So then, what? And for me, so then what is love? What I mean by love. And I've been checking with people a little bit recently, like, they describe the same experiences using a different name, like ease, or wideness, for example. And the qualities in the body and mind, etc., sound the same as what I experience and call love.
Is this the saying of every decision is right? There can't be any wrong decision?
But again, what if we find out someday? Till now, we haven't found out. So, we can keep trying, but meanwhile, so, then what? Maybe every decision is right. Maybe we'll find out every decision is wrong.
Does it mean then what?
Then what? Yeah, what else? What moves you? What's important? If we have no control, if we have some, if it's all in your hands, people say you create your reality also, right? So people are going to say everything. And that's usually helps contribute to the tail spin, crash, dive. Which is fine, because we can learn from that too, but okay, I just want to end with a poem. Part of a poem that some of you know I love, because I've read it before. It's by Carl Sandburg, from a long poem called Breathing Tokens. You were made for joy, child. Your feet were carved for that. Your ankles run for that. The rise of rain, the shift of the wind, the drop of a red star on a far water rim. An endless catalog of shouts, laughters, silent contemplations. They made you from day to day. For joy, child.